This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The COVID vaccine rollout. In some states, it's been relatively straightforward to get a vaccine. In others, it's been difficult to the point of absurdity. Take Lenore Vega. She lives in Naples, Florida. She's 70, a retired teacher, and has type 1 diabetes. She's stayed home for a year away from her grandkids throughout the pandemic. And now that there's a vaccine, like millions of Americans, Lenore Vega really, really wants it.
I try to be, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of person, so I try to make good out of anything. I am now 70 years old, and the last few months, I have to say the majority of my concern and time has been in trying to get the COVID vaccine. I started with the health departments. You know, I tried Lee County, Collier County, which is the county where I live. And I even went to Polk County, where I used to live. That's 2.5 hours away, because I figured I could get up there and back in one day. So I don't want to stay overnight anywhere. I've been keeping myself inside. I called my individual doctors, because my sister-in-law's in Orlando, Florida, which is Central Florida. Their doctors called them and said, hey, we want you to come. And they're younger than I am. But, you know, I'm still waiting. And my doctors said they have no access. So it depends on the allotment. It's a constant battle, and you just feel like the kid that never gets picked to play ball with you or play with you even, or sit next to you in the cafeteria. And it's just really the luck of the draw. And now it's almost become a madness, actually, because I feel like I'm in a race, the lottery, so to speak, to try to get a shot. And I've had shots my entire life almost with the diabetes. You know, you got to keep trying. So that's what I do. So tomorrow at 5:30, I'll wake up to be ready. My cousin's going to join me again. My husband's going to join me again. We'll all be ready with our 7 equipment pieces to get in.
And that's exactly what she did. Lenore got up early the next day with her helpers and their 7 devices. They tried to get Lenore a COVID vaccine appointment. Over the course of the morning, Lenore sent us 26 voice memos, documenting quite a journey.
I'm about to go in for the 555. If I hit the refresh button, it will automatically open up exactly at 6 o'clock. I feel like I'm being played completely getting up this early. Okay, now it's refreshed itself. But it says the same damn number, and I can't do anything. But I have to tell you, my heart is beating faster. I'm anxious. It's already changed now while I'm just talking to you to 2,308 remaining. But you can't tap anything. Nothing happens. 6:39, Collier is booked. Lee still has 435 remaining. But you see what happened. This is where I tell you we need one system, because we don't understand what's going on, and I don't understand what I can do next to advance. Now it says 2,314, 3 left, what?
Yeah, mine says 15, yeah.
But it won't let you tap it. And see, my refresh is no longer in my visibility unless I go up to the top, and I don't want to do that. Dilemma, dilemma. But the TV is also on, because usually across the bottom of the TV screen, they show you when it's closed. Well, we're below 2,000 now. We're at 1,963, and I don't know whether I should be hanging out here or not. 734. My coffee is now cold. I had one piece of cinnamon bread because I, like many other people, am a diabetic, and I have to make sure I eat something. What are they doing to us? 8 remaining, they say. How we can get to it, I don't know. 3 counties out of 20 are fully booked. So signing out for public supermarkets. Wasted time? Probably. The frustration is immense, and I don't get frustrated easily. Taught for 36 years, but I would take 2 or 3 classrooms full of 3rd or 4th or 5th graders or even middle schoolers before I'd ever have to do this again.
That was Lenore Vega, 70-year-old living in Naples, Florida, giving us the play-by-play of what it took for her to even try to get an appointment for a COVID vaccine. That was this week. She tried again the following day, and then the day after that, and still hasn't gotten an appointment. So this hour, we want to take a look at exactly what the Biden administration has promised and what it realistically can do to even out the COVID vaccine rollout across the country. And joining us now is Dr. Julie Morita. She was a member of the Biden Transition Advisory Panel. She's also Executive Vice President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and lead in the Chicago Department of Public Health for nearly two decades. Dr. Morita, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, what would you diagnose as the chief problem in the really uneven rollout we've seen thus far of COVID vaccines across the country?
I think one thing to think about is as you look at what's happened so far is to recognize that this is the largest, most expansive immunization effort that's happened in a very compressed period of time. So this is a complicated system. But when I look back on successful public health responses in the past, based on my time in Chicago, what I saw play out there, whether it was Zika, whether it was H1N1 influenza, or whether it was Ebola, was clear federal leadership, guidance, and coordination, and oversight of things like the vaccine distribution. And so those kinds of things are just beginning to happen at this point. When President Biden was inaugurated, the next day there was a federal response plan for the COVID response, which outlined a broad, expansive plan that included things about comprehensive vaccination campaign, expanding masking, testing, data, treatments, also protecting equity, really focusing on equity across racial and ethnic and urban lines. So these kinds of things are really, really critical for a comprehensive, smooth response. And those kinds of things will make a difference. It's not going to happen immediately, but it will definitely get better, and vaccine supply will get better as well.
So the masking, the testing, more comprehensive data, focus on equity, those are part of, as you said, a comprehensive COVID plan. But I would like to drill down specifically on the vaccine rollout a little bit more, because it's not clear to me, quite frankly, what is meaningfully different from the Biden plan from what the Trump administration had left on its way out the door? Because we were already seeing, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, but at least a million vaccinations a day in the transition, around the January 20th timeframe. Has that increased significantly? And if not, what specifically can the Biden administration do to get those numbers higher?
So I think when I talk about coordination at a federal level, I think I can get into that a little bit more in detail just to make it clear. What happened during the transition was there was connection between the federal government or the incoming administration and state and local health departments who are really on the ground doing this critical work. In the past, the state and local health departments did not get a lot of resources. So they didn't get money to support hiring more people to do the vaccination. They hadn't received resources to actually build up their immunization registry systems. So all those kinds of things weren't able to be done. Now the funds are beginning to flow. And so those things are actually beginning to happen. The other thing to keep in mind is that the vaccine was approved by FDA, recommended by CDC, and the vaccine arrived within days. That didn't give the state and local health departments much time to really ramp up their system. So when you look now at who's at the administration rates that are happening in the states and locals, you can see that's actually improving. More people are being administered more quickly. So there's definite improvement. The other thing is it was really, really difficult for state and local health departments to plan how many mass vaccination sites should they have? How many vaccines should they give to doctor offices? Because they only had a couple days notice about how much vaccine they were receiving. So they'd get 2 days notice and then they'd receive another allocation of vaccine. What the Biden administration has done is really committed to having an improved line of sight on the vaccine supply. And I've talked to a number of states and local health agencies already, and they're reporting that they're getting better projections for longer periods of time so they can do this kind of planning. Uh-huh. But it's not just because these changes have happened, it won't happen overnight. And so it's going to take some time to smooth things out.
No, that is very interesting. So those details really matter. And about that improved line of sight on supply. So specifically, one of the first things that the president did Actually, just a couple of days ago, on January 26th, as he announced that the administration is going to increase minimum weekly shipments of vaccines to states to 10 million doses, up from 8.6 million. And President Biden's guaranteeing those numbers for at least for the next 3 weeks. Is that realistic?
What we were struggling with during the transition was really having an incomplete picture of how much vaccine was going to be available, how it would be rolling out per week, per day, that kind of sense. The current administration now has that information, and so those kinds of projections are based on what they know. I believe that this can actually happen, and what the states are planning now takes those larger projections into consideration.
Okay. And then another thing, because, look, I'm a numbers person, and in a sense, controlling a pandemic really involves, like, getting the numbers right. The federal government is purchasing or has purchased 200 million additional doses of vaccine from Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech. Can we be confident that they can manufacture those doses in time for the overall projected rollout through the summer?
So a key thing to keep in mind is that in addition to committing to purchase these vaccines, there's also a commitment from the administration to actually support the supplies and materials that are actually necessary so that the manufacturers can ramp up production. So those kinds of things will also come into play. So that people talk about the Defense Production Act, which actually allows for improved supplies to these manufacturers. And there's a commitment on the part of the administration to do everything possible with the Defense Production Act to allow manufacturers to do that. So yes, I mean, it's not just the purchasing, it's also a matter of supporting the supply.
Okay. Well, so we also, when we come back, we're going to want to talk in more detail about that fulcrum. When we talk about state and federal coordination, I want to focus on exactly what that means and how that can be improved. So Dr. Julie Morita, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're trying to understand exactly what is needed to really equalize the COVID vaccine rollout across the United States and, in fact, enhance it as well. We've heard from a lot of On Point listeners about their experiences in either trying to get or getting the vaccine thus far. And here's Lynn McVeigh from Marion, Iowa. She shared her positive experience with us.
I received the COVID vaccine. It was very simple. And I'm really glad that I was able to get it because I work in the healthcare field.
And here's Ron Harrington from Ventura, California. He talked to us about how the Veterans Administration helped him get a vaccine.
They called me to say, since I'm over 75, I could get a vaccination. They set up both appointments. I drove to West Los Angeles, and they had already lowered the sign to over 65. They were very friendly, efficient, and well-organized. They gave me the Pfizer shot, explained everything, and gave me handouts to give me even more information. I was very appreciative.
It's Ron Harrington, an On Point listener from Ventura, California. I'm joined today by Dr. Julie Morita. She's executive vice president at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and was a member of President Biden's Transition COVID Advisory panel as well. And joining us now is Dr. Ashish Jha. He's the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, a general internist as well at Providence VA Medical Center. Dr. Jha, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So I'd like you, if you could, to give us your take thus far on the changes that the Biden administration says it's making to assist the vaccine rollout, and whether you think they're adequate, or if not, what more you'd like to see them do?
Yeah, it's a great set of questions. And I think obviously the Biden team, which has now been in place for about 9 days, was handed a difficult task, right? Because they're coming in the middle of the pandemic. There were very big promises made from the previous administration about how 50 million Americans would be vaccinated by the end of January, and but without much of a rollout plan. And what I have seen so far is much clearer and more transparent communication, a better sense that the federal government is going to partner with states. I think the last team really had this mental model that the states can all figure this out on their own. And so I'm optimistic that we're going to continue to see a ramp up. You know, we heard from President Biden earlier about 1.5 million doses a day as a goal. You know, I feel like my job is to push them and say, I'd like to get us to 2 million. I think we can get to 2 million a day. It's going to be hard, but that's the goal that we should be setting and trying to achieve, because we're in a race right now against these variants, and we've got to get people vaccinated. Mm.
Okay. So speaking to a very goal-oriented person here, Dr. Jha, so what would be your landmarks towards getting to that 2 million doses a day goal?
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, there's a question of, is that even doable? And there are obviously constraints. Like the biggest one is, can we make that many vaccines? Mm-hmm. But if you look at what both Pfizer and Moderna are saying, so we're not even talking about the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine or anything else, sticking with the ones we have, there is a sense that we should be able to produce about 200 million doses of these vaccines by the end of March. You know, there's about 60, 70 days left, and we've got, so to end of March, I'd like to get to a point where we are administering 2 million shots a day. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take the full power of the federal government, working very, very closely with states. We're a little over 1 million right now, and I want to see that number continue to tick up until we really do get to that 2 million a day, ideally, you know, by mid-February, if not earlier.
Okay. So supply is sort of the upstream issue here. We talked about that with Dr. Morita as well. But then as we push downstream more in this sort of logistical challenge of the ages, I wonder if there continues to be, if I can just put it this way, the public health version of that last mile problem, right? Because it's hardworking local officials who are ultimately putting shots in arms. So actually, let me just turn to Dr. Morita first, because, I mean, you led the Chicago Department of Public Health for almost 20 years. What do you think is needed most urgently in that last mile to help get shots in arms?
Yeah, so when I was at the health department in Chicago, and even now, there is a strong immunization infrastructure that is in place. We use it every day of the year to support vaccines in children. That's a $40 million doses of vaccine every year. But that is a focused on children. It's not meant for ultra cold storage of vaccines. And so there is a system that's in place that needed to be ramped up and strengthened. And what's happening now is there are dollars that are coming from the federal government to actually support enhancement of that existing system. On top of that, the Biden plan actually includes additional support, so additional manpower to help stand up mass immunization clinics, additional resources for mobile units, additional resources to federally qualified health centers to actually support the efforts that are already happening in state and local jurisdictions. So those kinds of things will actually complement and supplement the work that's already happening and will allow for enhanced vaccination to occur in the states and in the cities and the counties throughout the United States.
Okay. And so what did you make of Lenore Vega, who we heard from at the very top of the show in Naples, Florida, you know, 70 years old, having her husband and another member of her family all together with 7 devices, desperately trying to call, click, and tap at 5:55 in the morning for a spot. I mean, just even the way right now that in some states people are being asked to sign up for vaccinations feels like it leaves something to be desired.
Right. So I think what we should recognize is that while things are improving and there's more vaccine that's becoming available, the total number of doses that are available right now is much smaller than the numbers of people who are recommended to receive the vaccine. The CDC made recommendations regarding prioritization based on who was at highest risk for disease, who was most likely to die or be hospitalized, and also who was most at risk for getting exposed to the infection. Those kinds of things were taken into consideration. But the numbers right now that are being recommended, people 65 and older, healthcare workers, those far exceed the number of people, the number of doses of vaccine that are available. And so there will be this need to actually wait and pause a little bit and not necessarily assume that you'll get vaccinated right away. There will be enough vaccine ultimately, but right now when it's in short supply, there will be a need to kind of wait and pause. I think we all have this fear of missing out and feel this anxiety. I'm doing the same thing with my 91-year-old dad and my mother who's 86. And you know, we're going through the systems, trying to get appointments, that kind of thing. And we recognize while we're doing those things, we still need to make sure we're wearing our masks, socially distancing, avoiding crowds, doing those things will keep us safe until we can actually get vaccinated.
Dr. Jha, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with everything Dr. Morita said. And I guess I would add a couple of pieces to this. So I do believe that by the late spring, certainly by summertime, there'll be plenty of vaccines for every American. The question is, what do we do in the next couple of months? But there is no doubt in my mind that the lack of planning on how these vaccines were going to get distributed has been incredibly frustrating and has created a lot of confusion and at times has led to even inefficiencies and wastes of vaccine doses, which we've heard about. And, you know, I think about my parents' experience. So they're both in New Jersey. They're my mom's in her late 70s, dad in his early 80s. They spend enormous number of hours every single day trying to figure out how they can get a vaccine. And look, there is a mismatch right now between supply and demand, but the way you deal with that is a well-streamlined system. They should have been able to sign up somewhere, get on a list. They should be able to figure out where they are on the list and not have to wake up at 5:55 in the morning, as you know, as we heard earlier, and instead just have a well-streamlined system that gets them in when it's their turn. They're happy to wait. It's the kind of free-for-all disorganized. And I'm not blaming the local public health folks because they have been doing unbelievable work for 10, 11 months. What I am saying is they needed more federal support. They needed more resources. I agree that that is starting to now come, thank goodness. But we're going to need to continue to work on supporting the local public health people because they can't keep going like this and we can't expect them to pick up every single crisis and manage it effectively. Mm.
Dr. Morita, let me again lean on your experience at the Chicago Department of Public Health, because last year in 2020, when we did, following one of our many hours on, about vaccines, I actually received a very long and comprehensive message from a former public health official in Ohio, a county level official, who said that people should be ready because some kind of mass vaccine distribution infrastructure does exist based on the readiness plans that were put into place for H1N1. And he seemed pretty confident that things should go better or should have gone better than they are right now. So can you comment on that? I mean, there was this a push of some kind to get ready to vaccinate a lot of people for H1N1. Why aren't we seeing efforts being built on top of those already extant plans?
So there's a couple issues I think that are relevant to that question. The first is that number one, I guess basically it's the first thing is that it's resources. As Dr. Jha mentioned, the states and local health departments really did not get adequate resources in the initial phases to actually do the appropriate planning to build out and build up on those H1N1 plans. There are existing plans throughout the nation, but it's a very different response. COVID is a very different response than the H1N1 response. These vaccines that are available now are two-dose vaccines. They require ultra-cold storage or freezing. They're very difficult vaccines to get out. At the same time as people were supposed to be planning, these state agencies were supposed to be planning, they were also being held responsible for doing the testing, the treatment, managing outbreaks throughout their jurisdictions, and there weren't additional resources made available for them to hire more people or to enhance their planning. So it's not a big surprise that when the vaccine actually arrived at the end of December, these plans hadn't been enhanced. The data systems weren't improved. More people hadn't been hired. And so I think the key thing really is resources. While those plans existed, they really needed to be enhanced and improved and built out to adapt to this new pandemic.
Mm. You know, in a previous life, I studied engineering, and this just seems to be the public health version of like a deferred maintenance program on bridges. You just keep having, you can have cars pass over bridges and not understand that without maintaining the underside of the deck, it's falling apart. And then when you need it the most, the whole thing falls down. It feels like that's what COVID has done here for public health infrastructure in the United States. But I did want to hear from both of you about specifically what some states are doing right and maybe what some states they have where areas of improvement that they might have. So, for example, let's listen for a second to Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, who praised the Biden administration for committing to increase the vaccine supplies and giving states notice about where, when and where that allocation will be coming to them. And Governor Beshear says that is going to stop folks from making appointments and then having, or the state, I should say, from making appointments and then having to cancel them, something that's been happening and causing a lot of frustration.
Last week, we vaccinated about 82,500 Kentuckians, but we only received about 56,000 first doses. Now, we have some left over from the very first weeks when we were ramping up, but you can see our ability to vaccinate is far outstripping the supply we have. Right now, we believe we have the infrastructure to vaccinate about 250,000 people a week. But again, getting somewhere between 56,000 and even with the increase, maybe mid 60,000 vaccines. All this comes down to supply. Each state will work out its distribution issues. It all comes down to supply.
That's Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. Now, about distribution, West Virginia decided to rely on local pharmacies instead of the federal government's distribution plans for nursing homes and seniors. And so far, West Virginia has used 95% of its doses, the highest distribution percentage amongst all the 50 states. And here's what Governor Jim Justice said to CNN.
If truly today we had an unlimited supply of vaccine, I will promise you beyond any doubt whatsoever, every single person in the third oldest state with the most chronic illnesses that are 65 and above in West Virginia, all of them would have the vaccine in their arms by the 14th of February.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice there. Dr. Ashish Jha, what is West Virginia doing right, and should other states follow its example?
Yeah, so there are two sets of issues here, Meghna, that I think when we heard from the Kentucky governor, I've been spending a lot of time talking to health officials at states, and the single most important thing that they have brought up is the issue of visibility, that when you don't have time to plan because you don't know how many doses you're going to get, you can overshoot your planning and then disappoint a lot of people by canceling, or you can undershoot and then have a lot of doses left over and you don't know what to do with it. And that, of course, is also quite a problem. And so just basic communication, visibility, the change that the Biden team made of saying, we're going to tell you 3 weeks in advance, I think is going to make an enormous difference in moving these things forward in a more efficient way. In terms of West Virginia, what they have done is opted for simplicity. And this is a problem that a lot of states, I think, are struggling with. A lot of states came up with very elegant plans that balanced a variety of different interests, plans that I agree with, but they're very hard to operationalize. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they're having a hard time getting the vaccines out to people. And I think a simple approach that really just targets older people who are at high risk and then deals with equity issues, which are fundamental here, by making sure that we're setting up vaccination sites in communities of color. That's a strategy that I think is much better for us. It's going to be both faster and more equitable. But simplicity, 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 that's the name of the game at this point.
But so specifically, tell me, like, what does simplicity mean here? I just need a concrete example. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for instance, a lot of places have said, okay, we're going to do essential workers. Now they're spending a lot of time to figuring out who is an essential worker. And then how do you verify essential worker? And do you need a letter from HR, or do you do it on the honor system? Do you need people to, how are you going to authenticate a letter and make sure it's not forged? Who's going to verify this? All of these things add complexity that are making it hard to implement these policies. Age is the simplest thing to verify, right? Because people show up, people are used to being carded. You look at their driver's license or some other form of ID. And you can do things based on age. So That's what I mean, that the other things which are important, like essential workers, like people with chronic disease, actually add a lot of complexity to the system of verification. And that's where states are really struggling.
Oh, that's interesting. So, Dr. Morita, I want to hear your thoughts on that when we come back. But we just have to take a quick break. This hour, we are exploring exactly what the Biden administration has promised and what it realistically needs to do to really accelerate the COVID vaccine rollout across the country. And, of course, we're talking about what's happening at the state level as well. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're trying to understand exactly what the Biden administration is promising it will do in order to help accelerate the COVID vaccine rollout and whether it's enough. I'm joined today by Dr. Ashish Jha. He's the dean at the Brown University School of Public Health. And Dr. Julie Morita joins us as well. She's executive vice president at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and was a member of President Biden's COVID advisory panel, or transition advisory panel, I should say. And Dr. Morita, before the break, Dr. Jha was describing what I find to be sort of a very intellectually attractive approach, right? The simplicity and streamlining sort of the criteria of how we roll out the vaccine, age being a potential way of doing that. But I wonder whether that actually also introduces, though, some political complications, because as Dr. Jha pointed out, some states are trying to prioritize essential workers, for example, which makes a lot of sense because for a year we have been telling those essential workers that they are indeed essential and that the economy of the country, you know, really can't and hasn't been able to keep going without them. And on top of that, many of them are from communities of color. So how do you sort of balance out the speed and efficiency of a narrower criteria of who gets the vaccine and when with these issues of equity and what the sort of the broader country might need to really keep going?
So, yeah, that's an incredibly important point to lift up. And Dr. Jha mentioned it earlier in his comments related to the equity aspect of this. I mean, I think it's important to get the vaccine out quickly and to not have vaccines sitting on the shelves. But it also has to be balanced with making sure that who is at greatest risk for serious illness, for dying, for hospitalization, are getting vaccinated as well. But I don't think it's an either or. Mm-hmm. I think both things can be happening simultaneously. And what is a critical piece of doing that and doing that well is really having data to monitor who is actually getting vaccinated. It's really not enough just to say this percentage of the vaccines that have been distributed or allocated are actually administered. We really need to look at who's getting vaccinated by age, by race, by ethnicity, by gender, by occupation, so we can see, are we actually reaching the people who have been most severely impacted by the pandemic and by COVID-19? And so those data are really important. And I think that's another piece that we'll see playing out more, that as we move forward, there'll be improved data available to actually make those kinds of assessments. And that's also where the federal coordination piece comes in. Because at a federal level, the CDC, other federal agencies can look and see what states are doing well, what states are having success, what models, whether simple or complex, are working or not working, and then help disseminate best practices to the other states so that those kinds of practices can be adopted quickly. Without federal coordination like that, those kinds of lessons learned or good best practices just can't be shared as effectively or efficiently. And so there's important elements of focusing in on equity and also this level of federal coordination.
And would the CDC be the leading agency on that, the data collection and the coordination?
Well, the data collection actually occurs at the state and local levels. There's immunization registries that are in place in all 50 states. And then the CDC then takes and works with the states to kind of orchestrate and get a sense of what's going on. But the CDC when there's not in non-pandemic times plays that key liaison between the states and local jurisdictions. And so I would expect that they would do the same moving forward.
And can they? I mean, the CDC's had a very rough year.
So there are, I have faith in the CDC because there are a lot of career officials who have been there for many, many years, who have really lasted through the challenging times of last year and are there and working very hard to improve on the response so that we can do it better now.
Okay. Dr. Zhao, I want to give you a chance to respond because I know that you're not an either or person here. I didn't want to paint you as that, but go ahead.
Yeah, so definitely not an either or person on the issue of equity versus efficiency. In fact, I feel like this is the same conversation we've had about economy versus the virus.
Right.
Like actually, it turns out if you want to be really efficient, you got to target people who are going to be at high risk, and that gets you to equity. So what I have suggested is let's get to equity through distribution, making sure we're really setting up clinics and vaccination sites in those communities that have been the hardest hit. And that's how we ensure equity. Through more complicated rules, which may get us there, but will potentially slow us down so much that may end up really harming people who are at high risk.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the CDC thing, I think Dr. Morita is completely right. And there's a really important point that she mentioned that I just want to highlight, which is that the history of public health in America has always been a partnership between the federal government and states and local entities. And the local and state government really were supposed to be on the forefront, but that CDC was supposed to be a partner, helping on the state level and then coordinating across the government and across the country. And that partnership was substantially weakened in the last couple of years of the Trump administration in ways that I found puzzling, because the Trump team kept saying, we want the states to figure all this stuff out. And then in many ways undercut the ability of states to do it by really hampering the CDC, which was such an essential aid to states. I also agree that I don't actually know how these career officials didn't lose their minds and quit, but thank God they didn't. They've stayed on and now under a very different leader in Dr. Walensky, Rochelle Walensky. I think it's probably going to take a little time to regroup and get going, but I think the CDC absolutely can play that role and needs to play that role. There isn't anybody else who can step in.
Well, Dr. Zha and Dr. Morita, I wonder if you can listen along with me for a minute or two here, because we do continue to want to sort of touch down and hear from voices on the ground who are the ones at the front lines of this vaccine rollout program. And one of them is Erin Arada. She's an administrator at Custer Health. That's a public health department in North Dakota. And we actually first talked with Erin in late October of 2020, when at that time, North Dakota had one of the highest rates of disease, of COVID disease in the country. And she told us back then it was bleak.
I just don't understand how a regular citizen can sit back and just dismiss it all. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, a little more than 2 weeks after we talked with Erin, North Dakota finally issued a statewide mask mandate. That was on November 13th, and cases dropped. As of this week, North Dakota has just 50 people hospitalized statewide there, so things are getting better, though officials recently lifted the mask mandate. So we'll have to see if they can keep going with those good or better numbers. And now Erin's department has shifted its focus from COVID testing to COVID vaccination.
I think people are just saying, oh, the vaccine's here. North Dakota is distributing a lot of it. That's good. We're fine. We don't need to be as cautious anymore. But it does take a lot of work, and we don't necessarily have enough people to vaccinate as many people as quickly as we should. And that's what I'm struggling with right now.
And Erin says that securing staff and sites to host vaccine clinics are the biggest hurdles to effective distribution in North Dakota. Many communities rely on empty school buildings, but that's not an option where she is in the state because kids in Mandan, North Dakota, are back to in-person learning. They were able to rent a site for a large vaccination clinic this week, but there's a problem. with the plans to get patients a second dose of the vaccine.
Their facility isn't usable that day. And so we had to push off the second dose clinic a day or two. And then on that day, we don't have enough staff. And so it just kind of spirals out of control. We can give shots all day, every day, but it's all the other resources that need to fall into place that just aren't.
Well, Aaron's staff is obviously stretched thin, and some of them are frustrated that they aren't taking normal appointments so that they can prioritize vaccinations. But Aaron says her focus remains clear.
This is the number one way that we can get back to our normal life again. And I just keep stressing that. We just have to focus on this to get to the end goal. And we'll get back to everything normal, hopefully someday soon, although I have no idea what normal is. But I look forward to learning what it is.
That's Aaron Arada, an administrator at Custer Health, a public health department in Mandan, North Dakota. Now, so Dr. Morita and Dr. Jha, I want to spend the last few minutes that we have sort of talking about something that could ostensibly help this urgent push to get as many people vaccinated as possible. Because Dr. Jha, when you first came on a little while ago, you mentioned that we hadn't even mentioned the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And I did want to actually ask you a little bit about that. Do you think, because I've got some specific questions, it's all over the news today, do you think that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine could be helpful right now?
Yes. Short answer, yes. Look, we're still seeing the data. We got a single press release. We've got to dig in more. But the data that from the press release suggests that it has a profound impact on severe disease, on hospitalizations and deaths. And assuming that that's all correct, and I have no reason to think it's not, this will make a really big difference as well. We're going to need a lot of different vaccines to get the world vaccinated, get more Americans vaccinated, and Johnson & Johnson, I think, is going to end up being an important part of that solution.
I want to hear from you both about how you think people's confidence in vaccines, specifically COVID vaccines, is either being enhanced or diminished based on how it's talked about in the media. Because you're right, we only have this one press release about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But I just want to share some of the information, because it's been all over today, that 66% effective at preventing moderate and severe illness in a global trial, right, which was in the United States, South Africa, and Latin America. So how do I understand what that 66% number means, Dr. Jha?
Yeah, so if you look at their protocols, basically they're looking at people, obviously, who got vaccinated versus who didn't, and looking at underlying how many people got infected and ended up having moderate or severe disease, really symptomatic disease. So at least these data don't talk about asymptomatic disease. And they combine it across multiple places, including South Africa. We see much better efficacy in the U.S. because presumably in South Africa, we're also dealing with the South African variant. So that 66% number is a bit of a mishmash of a variety of different things. But when you dig in underneath it, you see, it seems to be quite effective, especially against more severe disease. And that's what we care about, right?
Yeah.
We want to prevent deaths and hospitalizations.
Well, so Dr. Morita, can I just ask you your thoughts about that? Because every single news story I've seen across today buries that very important piece of information that Johnson & Johnson is saying that their vaccine was 85% effective overall at preventing severe disease, and that in the course of their trial, all cases of COVID-related hospitalization or death happened amongst people who had received the placebo. So isn't this actually good news?
Right. So, Meghna, you make an incredible point. I totally had the same assessment as you, that piece of information about how effective the vaccine is against serious illness was buried. It really wasn't. That should have been the headline, actually, that the vaccine is 85% protective against serious infection in all three regions in which it was tested. So that's information and very, very reassuring.
Well, we just got about a minute and a half left. I was wondering if I could get a quick thought from both of you that, if you had one thing at the top of your wish list, again, on what we could do to push forward this vaccination campaign, Dr. Morita, what would be your number one wish list item?
So I'm seeing a lot of positive movement in terms of getting more vaccine out and improving distribution and administration efforts. What I am concerned about and what I really want to make sure is happening simultaneous to those efforts is reaching into the communities that have vaccine hesitancy or who aren't trusting the vaccine. Because when the vaccine supply improves and we're able to broadly vaccinate, we really want demand to be there for the vaccine. And so right now is a critical point in time to be reaching out to those communities that actually have questions and concerns about the safety or the efficacy of vaccine, understand what it is their concerns are, who do they want to hear from, and what do they want to hear about to actually help them feel more confident in getting the vaccines. So that would be on the top of my wish list.
And Dr. Zhao, your wish list item?
So I'm going to go a little bit of a different direction and say the other thing is if we want to think about the long-term protection of the American people, we also have to have a strategy right now to start helping the world get vaccinated. We're seeing the rise of these variants that put our own vaccines' efficacy at some risk, largely because there are such large outbreaks happening in many places. And part of a domestic strategy has got to include a global strategy so that the whole world gets vaccinated along with the United States.
Well, Dr. Ashish Jha is the dean at Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, it's always great to have you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Julie Morita, Executive Vice President at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Morita, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted to take the last couple of minutes of the show today to actually step back and say thank you to a very special member of our team. His name is Graham Griffith, and I've known Graham for almost 19 years. He's the original creator and executive producer of On Point, and he brought this show to life in the immediate, intense aftermath of 9/11 way back in 2001. And back then, I was a young, eager, and very inexperienced producer, but it was clear to me and anyone who worked with him that Graham was an exceedingly rare talent, a creative thinker, the kind of person who somehow is always able to cast his mind forward around the next corner to anticipate what might be coming next, or at least the kinds of questions that we as journalists should be asking next. Graham has also always been a deeply generous human being. So, of course, someone like that isn't going to stick around very long. Graham left On Point and founded several other public radio shows and initiatives, generally spreading his talent across the system. That is, until we asked him back. In January of 2020, it was obvious that in a world of on-demand podcasts, changing broadcast listening habits, and the necessity for a profound self-examination across journalism, that On Point needed to serve listeners in a new way for today's world. So we begged and cajoled Graham to come back and help us think through this all-important process. And he was only supposed to be with us for a couple of months. But then, well, 2020 happened, of course. So we couldn't quite quit Graham. He's led us for the past year. He was only supposed to be with us from January through March of 2020, but for the past year, he's led us with that same creativity, humanity, thoughtfulness, and grace that I recognized when I first met him those many years ago. And it is not too much to say that we could not have survived 2020 without him. Well, Graham is finally stepping away, off to new adventures and peering again around the next corners for the future of public broadcasting journalism. And I want to say today, we are so grateful to you, Graham, for your time and your talent. From all of us on Pudlians here, we can't thank you enough. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.